This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Lake County Council members got a chance to hear for the first time a bit more about the new wetlands law that is now in effect in Indiana. In fact, it's a measure that even a person on the General Assembly voted for it, called it controversial, and it certainly has turned out that way. Many of the state's environmentalists and Democrats spoke out against the bill all through this past General Assembly session, and some have also pleaded with Governor Holcomb to veto it, or not sign it at least. That wasn't the case. It's now law. And now Lake County Surveyor Bill Emerson has a chance to tell us more about the measure and what kind of impact it's going to have locally. Bill, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me. I'm really glad you invited me on. Wetlands are so important for the state and for flood control, for water quality, for habitat. Wetlands cover really 4% of the state, and they account for 50% of the habitat for animals in the state. So they're very important. And locally, I was disappointed in the law that was passed, removing protection for about 50% of the wetlands in the state, mostly isolated wetlands. So I'm working with our drainage board and our council to see what we can do about protecting wetlands here locally.
Mm-hmm. I understand from what I've heard about the measure, it was described that these wetlands that come under the measure are ones that are described like isolated, as you mentioned. They're out in maybe open countryside. How many of those would you guess, and you probably know, are in Lake County?
Well, we're actually looking at that now. I don't have an exact number on that. A lot of the wetlands we deal with along waterways would still be protected federally and through the state. But yeah, you're right. So the isolated wetlands are a little harder to quantify a lot of times, and it's kind of a case-by-case basis when folks want to develop a property or, in some cases, ask to just fill in a wetland for whatever reason. That's when they kind of come to the foreground when we look at them, especially in unincorporated areas that we have authority over under the Lake County Plan Commission.
Mm-hmm. Are there any in particular that come to mind that you know that there are wetlands out there that maybe come under this category that you'll have to keep a closer eye on because of the way that the law has now changed, that they can be covered over, filled in, developed over?
Well, off the top of my head, not really. I mean, that's kind of the problem when they're isolated. They could be, you know, in the back corner of an agricultural area that you may not even notice it. It may not be really causing anyone any issues, or you may not even know it's there. But once that property wants to be developed, or somebody wants to develop that property, they may want to just fill it in. And in the past, we'd have ways to have that property owner, they call it mitigate that impact, or to create a wetland in another area. But right now, the way the law is statewide, that doesn't seem to be a possibility. So we're looking at ways locally that we can kind of help preserve the natural environment here in Lake County.
Well, you mentioned here at the outset of the conversation about the fact that you're going to have to spend a lot of time looking deeper into these issues, and since they're kind of isolated all over the county, I suppose, that you'll have to be able to present something to the drainage board eventually so that they can take care of this matter.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what we're in the process of doing now. And that was sort of my request to the lawmakers earlier in the session, was to kind of take a breath and take a step back and kind of look at what we're doing here, because a lot of these wetland areas took millions of years to develop and into what they are right now, and they're so important for water quality and, like I said, for habitat and flood control, that I hated to see with one short session here all that undone. But that argument wasn't persuasive down there.
Now, we know, of course, from history of what's happened, for example, along the Kankakee River. It used to be a much, much wider, much more expansive wetlands many, many, many decades ago. But unfortunately, over the 20th century, they got cleared away, and we're kind of left with what we have now, trying to do the best we can in protecting like that whole area there along the Kankakee River, the marshes all around it.
That's exactly right, and it's ironic that now we're spending a lot of money trying to restore a lot of that area because of the flood control benefits and the natural habitat benefits, because of, you know, 100 years ago those were drained and many were filled in. So we're spending public money now to reestablish those areas, and so I feel like we're kind of taking a step back here with the isolated wetland law, but you know, we're gonna do our best locally, and that's all we can do.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any other ideas maybe that have been talked about with your colleagues, other county surveyors and other officials in other counties, in particular ones along the Kankakee River, just for an example, like in Porter County and points to the east, to try to deal with issues that are going to come up? And I'm sure that this had this ongoing discussion probably while the General Assembly was taking a look at this measure.
Yeah, and really the wetlands along the Kankakee would not be really impacted a whole lot by this law, because they're at the waters of the U.S. and the federal, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and EPA regulate those wetlands already, so that wouldn't be a huge impact. This law doesn't really impact the Kankakee that much, but there's always ongoing discussions with the Kankakee Commission on, you know, improving the wetlands and also improving flow. So it's kind of a balancing act. You want to store water, and you also want to keep the water moving. So,
I know that you've had an opportunity here to take a look at some of the projects that are underway. In fact, I'm sure that's probably been in the planning stages on some of the work that you'd like to be able to do or have contractors do along the Kankakee River. And you've asked for some funds to be able to go towards that. Can you tell us what you would like to be able to do, at least on your part, as the Lake County Surveyor?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. So, there's a lot of woody debris in the river right now. Excuse me, and those that wood and trees get jammed up in crossings and railroad crossings and things like that. So one of the things we're doing is kind of removing a lot of that woody debris, and also it's gotten so bad that in some areas, you know, you can't get a boat down very easily without hitting trees and things. So that's one of the main things we want to do, and also keeping sediment out of the river is important, because when the river was dredged in early part of the last century, it was just dredged to the state line and then was left natural in Illinois, and so a lot of the sediment from Indiana just drops out right here at the state line and right over the state line in Illinois. So keeping sediment out of the river is important as well. So we're doing some great work on the Yellow River, which leads into the Kankakee, which is a really sandy. Name the Yellow River because it is so sandy and yellow, and brings a lot of sediment into the system. So we're doing some work, bank stabilization, things like that, on the Yellow River to make sure that sediment stays out of the river.
Mm-hmm. How much of this are you going to be able to do while the weather's still nice here during 2021?
We have a project right now at the Grand Kankakee Marsh in Lake County that we're going to get started here in the next, hopefully, month or so, with the water being down and into the summer, bank stabilization project. So it is important to make sure you work with the weather and you don't get when the river's down to do a lot of this work.
So. Right. I imagine you worry about what's going to happen during flooding time. It's going to happen. It happens every spring, it seems, and every fall, you know, after the snows that we usually get melt away and fill up certainly there on the marshes and in turn going into the Kankakee River.
Absolutely. And we've been lucky from that perspective. This year it's been historically dry. Spring, so we haven't had issues that we've had in the past. And 2018 in February was just a historic event that really got a lot of the updates to the Kankakee River Commission started. And so we've had a lot of really early spring rain events that have kind of overwhelmed a lot of areas. So we've been lucky that way this year.
And I know that the comments that were mentioned here, certainly from State Representative Niemeyer, who I guess had a chance to talk with the Lake County Council about the measures that came up during the General Assembly session. This one, the wetlands bill in particular, probably the council hasn't had a lot of chance to respond to what they probably heard that day.
That's true. And I'm not sure if they will or if that's going to be kind of a work in progress. And I know there are folks that Senator Niemeyer represents that did have some issues, you know, especially the agricultural community, with maintaining their fields and wet areas, and there were some legitimate concerns on that end as well. It was just, I guess, like I said, my hope that they would have kind of put it on the back burner, looked at it a little closer over the summer here, but that wasn't the case.
Slate County Surveyor Bill Emerson Jr. talking about a recent discussion before the Lake County Council about the new wetlands measure and the concern that the environmentalists as well as farmers may have about what's been passed by the General Assembly. And Bill, thank you very much for spending time talking about it with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Reaching adulthood brings new challenges such as jobs, school, and relationships, and all of that can affect a young person's mental health. But navigating the healthcare system to get help with that is not often very easy, as we find out in this from Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson.
Noelle Broughton is an accomplished student. She's in a graduate program at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and is headed for a PhD. She also struggles with anxiety and self-doubt. As a child, she had a few therapy sessions, but they didn't last. Now, at 25, she wants to try treatment again before heading to the University of Kansas for her doctorate in public administration.
But then once I actually took the step to do so, I realized how difficult it is. It feels impossible at times.
Broughton has been looking for a mental health provider who is female, a person of color, and in network. She's had no luck in the past year.
I feel like every time I find someone who checks two of those boxes, maybe they don't check the third box.
So as she prepares to move west, she questions if seeking treatment is worth it. Many other young adults face similar problems when it comes to mental health services. It's especially challenging for those who suddenly lose the support of school counselors. Jedediah Carter grew up in a rural town with limited mental health care, but family support helped him get through high school. When he moved to Indianapolis for college, he wasn't ready for the academic challenges and being on his own.
It's tough to, you know, be out as a young adult trying to navigate this brand new world for the first time.
Carter is now 24 and taking a break from school to regain control of his mental health. Finding care for depression and anxiety hasn't been easy. While taking classes, he could use IUPUI's mental health services. But now that he's not enrolled, he has lost access to them. He struggled to find a provider on his own.
It feels like you are being forgotten or left, you know, because nobody's returning your calls. But I was like feeling a little bit of a crisis that I needed to get this started or things were only going to get worse.
There's a term for Broughton, Carter, and others like them. They're called transitional young adults because from age 16 to 26, many graduate high school, attend college, or enter the workforce. Anita Everett of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration says this all heightens the risk of mental illness.
We know that people are making decisions that can impact the rest of their lives and things like that. There's a lot of sort of stress and a lot of pressure on individuals in that age group.
Nancy Roy is a psychologist with the Jed Foundation, which supports the emotional health of young adults. She says insurance plays an important role in getting treatment.
If you do have insurance, then at least you have the structure of being able to go online or pick up the phone and call the number on the back of your card.
Roy says it can still take a long time to find a provider that is taking new patients. Another problem, there aren't enough providers. A Kaiser Family Foundation study found that in Indiana, nearly a quarter of adults with symptoms of depression or anxiety had an unmet need for counseling or therapy. And a University of Michigan study found there are only 6 psychiatrists in Indiana for every 100,000 people. Both trends line up with national data. Everett says Congress is trying to help by boosting funds for young adults who've had their first psychotic episode. Through this funding, every state has at least one program to increase access to care.
And the whole concept there is to identify that as early as possible and help those kids, those people, young adults, get back on track.
Carter spent 6 months searching for a provider. He finally made an appointment, but he knows he's lucky to still be on his parents' insurance.
I do feel like the system is way harder than it needs to be, especially for, you know, I think something that is essential.
From Side Effects Public Media, I'm Darian Benson.
There is an organization called the Northwest Indiana Mutual Aid Initiative, which is made up of several grassroots volunteer-based organizations that have come together and just this past weekend had a mutual aid pop-up held in East Chicago. Let's find out more about the groups and about the event itself and what's ahead for the organization. Michael Santos is with the Northwest Indiana Mutual Aid Initiative, and thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
Will you tell us a little bit about the initiative itself and the organizations that make up the initiative?
Yeah, absolutely. So this initiative really just got started this past month. And, you know, we're just a small group of volunteers from across the region. You know, we've got members in Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties. And we really decided to start this initiative because we recognize that, you know, there's really a great need in our communities right now just because of, you know, all the just horrific economic crises that we're faced with. You know, the working class here in Northwest Indiana is faced with, you know, declining wages, mass unemployment, and, of course, a global pandemic, which has really just, you know, devastated so many communities here in the region. And so, yeah, you know, we really just saw how, you know, people in our communities were, you know, struggling to meet their basic needs. And, you know, we decided to kind of step up and try to respond to that through collective action. Mm-hmm. So in terms of our organization, so, yeah, we've got three groups that are a part of it. We've got the NWI Collective, Just Transition NWI, and NWI Solidarity. All three of them, you know, really great organizations. So NWI Collective and NWI Solidarity were two groups that kind of emerged out of the protest movements last summer. Really great group of activists in both. Cannot speak highly enough of them. And Just Transition NWI is a group that actually just got started up this past year. We're an environmental justice group fighting for a just transition to renewable energy here in the region.
It looks like that all of the organizations together as one group have covered, the complete gamut of organizations and people in Northwest Indiana that need the help the most. And will you tell us, when getting the first mutual aid pop-up started in East Chicago, what work did everybody have to get together to do to, first off, to get all these items together? And what did you often have available for the event on May 8th in downtown East Chicago?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it was definitely a kind of whirlwind planning process. Really, it was the product of only about a month worth of planning. But a lot of stuff had to come together pretty quickly for it. You know, we're entirely volunteer-based, and we're not getting any, like, you know, big funders or, like, philanthropies or anything like that. So it was all, you know, entirely based on donations from people here in the region. We actually had different donation drop boxes set up across the region. And those included, we had one at the East Chicago Public Library in the Harbor, one at Grindhouse Cafe in Griffith, one at First Presbyterian Church in Michigan City, and one at Sip Coffee House in Highland. And, people were able to drop off supplies at those. We were looking for, you know, non-perishable food items, gently used clothing, toiletries and household items, things like that. We were also collecting monetary donations, we were just collecting those for a few weeks, and once we got all that together, we decided to have the event at Unity Plaza in East Chicago, and that was kind of a brief overview of the planning process mm-hmm. that went into it.
For people that aren't familiar where Unity Plaza is located, it's really in the heart of the downtown district there near in the harbor area. It's at 138th and Main Streets in East Chicago. And it's really just a park area, an urban park area, we should say, because there are businesses and buildings all around it. When it came time to get everything set up, you have all these donations together and probably lots and lots of boxes and things that you get to haul over to the site. How was the setup for the morning of the 8th ahead of the giveaway in the afternoon?
Yeah, so a lot of it we tried to sort of plan in advance. So we actually had a couple different days of where we kind of worked to like sort through the materials and get them loaded up onto some trucks. We actually had quite a bit of stuff, which of course, took quite a while to organize and sort, which is, of course, a good problem to have. We just tried to, you know, plan as much of that in advance as possible. Thankfully, we had, a large group of people helping us, so many different activists
from across the region that, you know, came together in support of this initiative. And, if not for all those people, there's no way we would have been able to make it happen.
Now, come the day of the event on Saturday the 8th, tell us how things went. First off, to start the day, you mentioned about all the setup and the planning that you had to have already in place before the event. Tell us when noon came and the actual mutual aid pop-up began. Tell us what the atmosphere was like and how things went through the day.
Yeah, so when we were getting set up there, we set up right there on the corner of 138th and Main Street. We kind of set up our tables in sort of like a U shape and, tried to set it up so that, you know, kind of the foot traffic could sort of flow through as, efficiently as possible. We did end up getting, pretty large crowd that came out. I don't have the exact numbers, but all told, we ended up handing out about a total of 60 bags worth of supplies. And, and actually ended up giving away pretty much all the supplies that we had collected, which, you know, was really great. We ended up handing out all the materials. You know, folks were, very happy to see us. We got a lot of good reception, good response from the community. And, I think it really showed, how much there was really, a need for this type of stuff because, while we were doing it, we were, talking to the people that were coming through, of course, and, really just kind of, they were all sharing, all the different kinds of hardships that they've been going through these past, few months. I would say it was a really good reception. And, overall, I think, went very, very effectively. We did, unfortunately, at the start there, the East Chicago Police Department actually tried to shut us down at first. They came by and tried to say that we were supposed to have, some kind of permit or whatever. And we insisted upon, being able to, exercise our right to, one, freedom of assembly, and also being able to, just help out people in our communities. And after kind of, interacting with them for a little bit, we explained that, we were, of course, doing everything safely. We were sanitizing all of our materials, washing our hands, wearing face masks and gloves and all that stuff. Thankfully, that didn't become an issue. Well, we did have that short little hiccup at the beginning there. But other than that, the event went off really without a hitch. And, really good response from the community.
That's good to hear. Now, obviously, you have this first mutual aid pop-up taken care of. Any more that are in the works or coming up here through the next few months?
Yeah, so our goal is to do these really all across the region. So our next one is going to be in Michigan City on Sunday, June 13th from 12 to 2 p.m. And that's going to be at the First United Methodist Church. And for this one, we're going to be partnering with Chef Eric Tannehill and the Emergency Soup Kitchen, which, again, cannot speak highly enough of Eric. You know, he's doing really great work out there with the Soup Kitchen. So we're going to be partnering with them for that. The Soup Kitchen will be passing out food while we're, doing the pop-up. So, again, that's going to be from noon to 2 p.m. After that, our next location is going to be in Gary. We don't have an exact date or location for that one yet, but we're aiming to have that out pretty soon here in the coming days.
Mm-hmm.
So once we have that out, we'll be, of course, making an announcement on our Facebook page.
Okay. Well, Michael Santos is with Northwest Indiana Mutual Aid Initiative. They've started out a series of mutual aid pop-ups. The first one was held last weekend in East Chicago, and we're looking forward to all the others. Thanks for being with us to tell us about it.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for the invite.
Hoosiers who are interested in seeing more women elected to public office have an opportunity to find out more in a very interesting training session. It's going to happen virtually. It's called Ready to Run Indiana, and it'll take place on May 22nd. And to tell us more about it, we have the executive director of a group called Women, the number 4, Change. Rima Shahid is with us. And Rima, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you. Good morning. Glad to be here with you.
Will you give us first just a brief idea of what the Ready to Run Indiana organizations, which is part of, I guess, a national programming network, is all about?
Yeah, Ready to Run is actually a part of Ready to Run National, which is out of Rutgers University. It is an all-encompassing nonpartisan initiative geared to encouraging and training women interested in seeking office, or as well as those that are just wanting to learn more about the process or maybe working on a campaign. And the overall goal is to help increase the number of women in office, and particularly for Ready to Run Indiana, mm-hmm. we're wanting to do that here in our great Hoosier State.
Well, I know we've had some gubernatorial candidates people who have shown interest in being governor that are women. And there's some other people, of course, that we have a number of women who are in Congress. We have women that are involved in state government, but probably could add more to the list, beef up the ranks, so to speak, add more women to the ranks of public office that you as an organization are facing?
Absolutely. So last year in 2020, we commemorated the 19th Amendment, which gave some women the right to vote. But if we take a step back and think about the fact that here in Indiana, so it's been 100 years since the 19th Amendment passed, but here in Indiana, we've never had a woman governor, and we've never had federally women senators. We've only sent a handful of women to the United States Congress. And in terms of the Indiana State House, we rank well below the national average of 24.2% of state legislatures are made up of women. Mm-hmm. Well, here in Indiana, we're about 21% if you look at some of the data and surveys. And what we know is that when women are in positions of elected officials, they work together collaboratively to get the job done.
What are some of the topics that you hope to be able to bring up with this virtual event happening on May 22nd?
Time and time again, what I hear out in the community is, you know, if you're interested, run for school board. But the question is, how do I run for school board? Do I need money? Do I need a communications team? And what does the job entail? What are my responsibilities? So we're hoping to demystify and answer some of those questions around campaign finance, around communications, around how to talk with others, debate, things like that. That's what we're really hoping to get from. Because, again, when women run and when women win, the community at large does better.
Okay. Let's break down some of these specific topics I know that you're going to bring up in the event coming up. Let's talk first about fundraising. What are things that should be brought up that women may have had experience, certainly if their husbands have been involved in public office, that they may not know, that they should know?
Yeah, absolutely. So something that women actually face when they're running is a lot of scrutiny. People are looking at these candidates under a fine microscope where they're not looking at men like that. And so folks wonder, well, will I be able to fundraise? And you'll be surprised when people throw their hat in the ring, you'll have neighbors and others that support you. But again, it's about taking that first step and understanding what do you need in your pocketbook or in your tools to be able to take that first step.
And I would imagine, too, that volunteers and getting people to help volunteer for your particular campaign is very important.
Exactly. And again, we have, you know, being members of the community, we are volunteers ourselves, we help others. And so it's being able to ask for help and identifying, this is what I need from you. And we will find more often than not, people will step up and support those candidates. But it's about just empowering people to make sure that they know how to make those asks and identify those so that others can help them.
Now, the organization Ready to Run Indiana is set up, as you mentioned earlier at the start of our conversation, is a bipartisan effort. And so politics, unfortunately, do have to be involved. How does one be able to navigate party politics? And obviously, that's going to be a topic you'll talk about, right?
Yes, absolutely. But here, I think what people have to remember is that the bipartisan or the lack of bipartisan efforts are mostly in Washington, D.C. Here in Indiana, in our Indiana State House, we see folks working across the aisle to pass meaningful legislation on behalf of Hoosiers. The issues that Women for Change follows, for example, majority, if not all of those, have been authored and co-authored by women from both sides of the aisle. It's refreshing if you ever have an opportunity to walk into the State House, you will see people from Democrats and Republicans just standing together working to ensure that they are passing these legislation that Hoosiers really need. And right now what we know is that COVID-19 has really hit women the hardest in terms of jobs lost, trying to take care of children while virtual learning, and they are the majority of our frontline workers. But we need to pass legislation that supports those same very women, and that's, again, why we need more women in office.
It's a matter of women being involved in politics or just in any kind of elected public office. You have family members that certainly want to be supportive, but how do you work with them to get them ready for what they may face as you go through the campaign?
Right, and that's another conversation that we're going to be having, is what do you need to tell your family? Because the unfortunate truth is that our candidates do need to have a pretty thick skin. And so what can a family member expect? How long are the hours? What does canvassing look like? What is that door-to-door? Are they going to be asked to make phone calls? How do they respond to positivity or negativity regarding their family member that's a candidate? And I think that's important that family members and friends have a really clear understanding of what that looks like as a candidate and hits the campaign trail.
Yeah. Rima, will you fill us in on some of the other participants in the Ready to Run Indiana event that is coming up virtually on May 22nd?
We have a number of people that are signed up, but what I'd really like to talk about is our previous Ready to Run events.
Uh-huh.
Our first Ready to Run, we had 140 people that came to that event, 70 of which either ran for office themselves or started working for a campaign. The next year, we had around 50 to 60 participants, and at least a third of those either ran for office or they were working on a campaign. So this is a really great model. We find people getting fired up, involved, and it can be anywhere from your local municipal level all the way up to state representatives that have been candidates that have attended Ready to Run in the past.
And will you fill us in, please, on how people may want to participate in this virtual event coming up on May 22nd, Ready to Run Indiana?
Yes, absolutely. So you can visit our website. It's www.women4changeindiana.org. So you can sign up and attend the event. If you need a scholarship, please feel free to email us at welcome@womenforchangeindiana.org. We never think that cost should be a barrier. Cost should never be a barrier to attend and get involved civically and politically. So we do offer free scholarships to anyone that is interested.
Rima Shahid is the Executive Director of Women for Change Indiana, and the organization is working to set up a virtual event that begins on May 22nd at 9 a.m. and runs through the day on that date. And find out more by going online. Ready to Run Indiana, part of the network that has been founded to help recruit and train women to become more involved in politics. Rima, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.